as a model for Samar. And in particular, what I'm going to do is show you how you might set up a genetic screen to look for the kind of mutants that you're interested in. So I'll talk more about that in a minute. But basically, the idea is that you would learn how you would use this model system to study a process, a biological process, that's of interest to you. And in the process, on a sort of need-to-know basis, I will go into what the experimental advantages of the yeast system are, why it's such a good system for taking a genetic approach to studying a biochemical problem. And along the way, what we'll see is we'll develop a collection of mutants, we'll figure out how to analyze the mutants, what the experimental advantages of yeast as a genetic system are for being able to determine how many genes there are that can mutate to give you a phenotype of interest to you. And then with that original collection of mutants, how you can really take advantage of the yeast system to find other genes, including proteins, that participate in the process that you're interested in studying through their ability to either mutate to suppress your original mutation or mutate to exacerbate your original mutation. So basically, using genetics to find interacting proteins in a genetic system. So have any of you worked with yeast at all? Okay. The other thing I have to tell you, and I already see that you're not accustomed to this is going to be a chalk talk. So I'm going to develop these ideas on the blackboard, so hopefully you're prepared to take notes. But these websites on the handout that I'm going to hand out in just a minute are useful because there's several sources we can look at, and the general approach is outlined by other people. There's some PowerPoint slideshows that are being given at other universities, for example, and you'll see often they very much parallel what I'm doing. So there are other sources out there. But I think it's useful to develop this on the chalkboard because I think, at least in my experience as a student, it's much easier to watch somebody develop an idea than it is to put up an idea that's already completely fleshed out. So I prefer this way of teaching. So it may not be what you're accustomed to, but hopefully you'll just relax, try to follow along, answer, you can ask questions, you can come find me later. All right, let me start with this. So this handout, this package, as I said, has several websites that I think you'll find useful. It also has some problem sets. And so there's a complementation table that by the end of the lecture today, I will have walked through how a table like this is generated, and what you're supposed to do is take this table. And before we meet on Tuesday, we're supposed to look at the table, reorganize it, and try to deduce everything we can about what the screen is telling us. And I'll say more about that later. The other thing that's here is a problem set that gives you an opportunity. So one of the powers of yeast, see, is that it's very easy to do linkage analysis, so you can tell how closely linked your genes are. And that's because you can detect that analysis, which we'll get to in a minute. And this is a problem set we get to apply that and see if you can map the distance between two genes. And again, you work on that over the weekend on Tuesday, and we'll go through these at the beginning. Okay? So I'm going to just take one of these. And then this package was just duplicated by Secretary of the Department. Is a package of three papers that I'd like you to read, some classical papers in yeast genetics. So the first one you should read, these aren't stapled, fortunately. You should just the first one you should read is actually, you'll know which one it is. It's a very old paper, and I apologize for the poor quality, but the only place it's available right now is on microfilm, and it's hard to get a good copy of it, but I think you can read it. This is a classical paper that actually describes a collection of mutants that was made by Lee Hartwell, that really mapped out the cell division cycle in yeast, and he actually got the Nobel Prize for that work. As I said, it's an old paper, but it's really worth reading, and I think it's kind of fun to go back and read. So that one you should read first. It's followed by a paper that just has some examples of how you set up genetic screens that I think is useful on temperature sensitive mutants, how you isolate, how you analyze them, and so forth, that will follow along pretty carefully with the lecture. And then the last paper, which we won't get to until the week from today, so you don't really need to read it until before the lecture on next Thursday, is a paper on a genetic screen to find interacting proteins, which we'll get to either later on Tuesday or Thursday. Okay. So are there any questions about that? Okay. there were 17 of you out there, is that right? This is by far the biggest amount of class we've ever had. So, really, this is pretty informal, and I would really encourage you to interrupt and ask questions if you have questions as we go. But on the first page of this package I'm putting up, there's actually just a sheet I zero up on how to look at TETRAD's data. Did everybody get both packages? Does anybody have questions before we start? Overhead projector in here, anywhere? So what I would like to encourage you to do as we start thinking about this is I'm sure that all of you have some process, you have some idea what you want to work on. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But what I think it's kind of fun to do with this series of lectures is to try to think about whatever process you think you might be interested in studying and try to think about how you might use these to study that process. So you might think because you're interested in pathogenesis, bacterial pathogenesis, maybe there's no applications for yeast. You're interested in studying some kind of a mammalian problem that's unique to mammalian cells, a developmental problem, whatever. You might think there's no advantage to using these, but actually, it's surprising how often you can, for example, introduce heterologous genes. So, for example, in my lab, one of the things we're doing is taking these cells and reprogramming them to make lipids that you normally find only in plants by putting Rhabdopsis genes into the yeast. So all the things I'm going to talk about in terms of genetic screens and so forth, we can do using Rhabdopsis genes. We're just taking advantage of the yeast as a host cell to express them. So I'd just like you to think about that and try to think about, well, how might I ever use this? We'll also see when we get to interacting proteins. Yeast are frequently used to look for protein-protein interactions between totally heterologous proteins, for example, the two hybrid screens, which you may or may not be familiar with yet. Have you talked about two hybrid screens, Jeff? Okay, because that's something we will talk about more, but basically that's a way of using, that's a genetic screen you can do in yeast where you're looking for interactions between two proteins that don't even have to be yeast proteins. So if you're interested in looking at mapping the interactions between two proteins that are involved in a pathogenic mechanism, you can express them in yeast and get a lot of information about where they physically interact with each other, so on and so forth. So what I'm asking you to do is don't think of this as just only be of interest to me if I really want to work on a yeast problem. The idea is to exploit the system to study whatever problem you want. Okay. All right, so the premise starting out is that the goal of almost everybody is to understand the problem that they're interested in studying at the highest possible level. Okay. That you really want to understand exactly how the process works. You want to understand the mechanics of it. You want to know what all the proteins are that are involved in it. You want to know how it's regulated. And that there's advantages to asking those questions in the simplest possible model system you can, where you can do genetics and biochemistry and cell biology, put them all together. And so that's, of course, the advantage of using model systems and why people have used model systems traditionally in research. And yeast actually was the very first eukaryotic organism for which the genome was sequenced. We had the genome of the yeast, we had the sequence of the yeast genome for, well over 10 years now. And we know the functions of about 70% of the genes in yeast. So it's a really highly developed model system as well as a very useful one, because it is useful, it's highly developed. But basically, I would say most of the time when you're in your projects, as a student and later as an independent researcher, a lot of what you'll be doing is trying to make an association between a gene and the protein it encodes and a biological function that the protein is involved in. So there's basically two general strategies that people use for doing this. Genetic strategies that people use for doing this. One is what we call a reverse genetics approach, and one is what we call a forward genetics approach. So does that mean anything to you? Have you talked about that yet?
So
So we generally think a forward genetics approach would be okay if there's a process we're interested in, right? Might be, so what are some processes you're interested in? Tell me some things you're interested in. Basic biological processes. Okay, so there's a metabolic pathway you're interested in. You're interested in what? Synthesis of amino acid, or metabolism of sugar, or what are you thinking about? I don't know if that. I missed it. Amino acid. Okay, that's a good one. So it's very easy to devise a screen to find these mutants that can't make the amino acid, right? Because you can provide the amino acid in the media. So if you get a mutant where they can't make the amino acid, they can take the amino acid up from the media, then they can grow fine. So what you would do, for example, is mutagenize the cells, grow them in the presence of the amino acid, and then replicate the media that doesn't have the amino acid, and find things that can't grow without the amino acid, prove that it's the amino acid that you need by adding it back. And so that would be a forward genetic screen. You start with a function, the synthesis of an amino acid, let's say, the synthesis of tryptophan. So your forward genetic screen is to find mutants that can't do the process. But then you work from the mutant that has a failure to do it, so you clone the gene by complementation, and that way get to the gene, so you find a fragment of the mutant genome that can rescue the amino acid synthesis deficiency, and that way get to the gene, and then from the gene you can deduce what the encoded protein is, and often from the sequence of the protein you can get information about what step in the pathway might be involved. You may have some predicted cofactor utilization that suggests to you that it might be catalyzing this step or that or whatever. Okay. So you can see deductively start with it's called the forward genetic screen because you start with a mutant and you work forward to get to the end of what a protein is. The reverse genetic screen is you say, okay, I think this protein might be involved in the process. So you start with the protein, work backwards to the gene, make a mutation or deletion in the gene, and ask, does it in fact have the phenotype that I predicted with because I thought this protein might be an enzyme that's involved in tryptophan synthesis. So those are the two general strategies people take, forward genetics approaches and reverse genetics. Obviously, in a reverse genetic approach, you have to have some way of predicting what proteins are involved in the process. So if you're interested in chromosome segregation, and you look at a mitotic spindle, and you say, well, there's a lot of tubulin there. I mean, historically, people said, well, gee, we think tubulin is probably involved in chromosome segregation, and you make mutants in tubulin, and you ask, does it in fact affect chromosome segregation? So, for the reverse genetic approaches, you actually have to have some way of predicting what proteins are involved, and then you can test that and get into the gene and make mutations and see what the phenotype is. For the forward genetics approach, you don't really have to make any assumptions, except that you have a phenotype to say, well, I think that if there's a defect in chromosome segregation, then I should see loss of chromosome. Okay? So your screen might be okay. I'll set up a screen that will tell me I'm mutants with an increased rate of chromosome loss. And then I'll work from those mutants to get to the gene and the protein and see if I can find the things that are required for chromosome segregation. So generally you understand the difference between reverse and forward genetics approaches. Okay. So many of you probably have worked in a chromosome. I asked at the beginning if anybody had worked on yeast tonight. My wife, but nobody has. I think I derailed and started talking about something else and didn't listen to the answer. Has anybody worked on yeast?
What do you mean by that?
What do you mean by that?
I worked with 6,000 injection proteins.
So you worked on interactome with yeast with other things?
Yes.
Then you worked with yeast, right?
Well, but not in, I worked in a dry lab, not a wet lab. So.
Okay. So you're familiar with some of these strategies, but you haven't physically done experiments with yeast.
Yes.
Has anybody, so nobody's actually worked with yeast? Well, after you finish these lectures, you're going to be sorry. I just came in. Okay. So many of you probably have worked in E. coli, right? So
obviously that's been historically that's a really powerful experimental system. And in fact, a lot of what we know about metabolism is pilgrim studies in the for example, using forward genetic and more recently reverse genetic approaches. And the advantage of the E. coli are obviously that it also has a very well-developed genetic system. It's you can do molecular biology, you can transform E. coli very readily. You can do biochemistry, you can do molecular biology. The problem with E. coli is it's limited in the sense that it is not a eukaryotic cell. So if you want to study processes that are uniquely eukaryotic, then you really need to move to a higher model. What one of the things I'm hoping to convince you is that yeast in many ways has all the experimental advantages of working with E. coli. In fact, in many ways it's actually easier to work with E. coli. But it allows you to study processes that are uniquely eukaryotic. And so some of the advantages of working with yeast, anybody when you think about what would be the advantages of a model system, we have some of the considerations. Things you would be looking for from one of the easy model systems. Easy to grow. In fact, these cells under optimal conditions will double about every 90 minutes. So they're fast to grow and easy to grow. And they grow them in liquid health, you can grow them on plates or slipping to anything for life. How many people work with E. coli? Has anybody not ever worked with even yeast or E. coli? Right. So they're easy to grow, they're also cheap, by the way. And that's not a small consideration if you're some experiments are just so intrinsically expensive that it's hard to get funding to keep them, but they're very inexpensive. there's no ethical questions, right? I mean, most people don't worry about killing these cells. So, like looking with animal models, that you do have ethical issues to deal with, and you also have a lot of bureaucratic paper to deal with the animal abuse and stuff. So, obviously, you had a choice between working with yeast and animal cells, and you could ask the same questions if very advantageous to work with these. But they're not pathogenic, they're very safe. In fact, we use yeast to make bread, to make beer. So, that's another good reason to work with yeast to make beer and bread. But when you get to the advantages from a genetic point of view, there are actually advantages that you don't have in E. coli. And that's that yeast can exist both as stable diploids and stable haploids. So I look at that. You have both a diploid and a haploid life stage. And of course, the advantage to that is you can make mutations in essential genes in the diploid. And because you'll have one good gene and one bad gene, you can maintain mutations in the diploid state. The advantage of being in a haploid is that you can find mutations. It's very hard to find mutations in a diploid organism because even with a really good mutant stream, you have to get both genes mutated to get the phenotype, and that's just very hard to get. So you can do these things in a haploid. Shove it in there. don't have a particularly potent homologous recombination system, so it's hard to do targeted gene replacement. So they need to for these to target the genes to where you want to make them because they have this homologous recombination. We'll see that that's very valuable in the approach to genes. So basically then it allows targeted gene replacements in our head. Okay, and I already said it's the first eukaryotic organism for which the entire gene is sequenced, and there's a one of the websites that's on the handout that I gave you, and it is the Saccharomyces genome database, which is an incredible research that I've published about Saccharomyces. By now, you can go and you can find a new gene of interest, you can find out what exists in the localization, maybe you can find out what it is, but they're not, how much you can find out, which I really encourage you to go look at that website. You just pick up two genes and see what you can find out. Okay, but in addition to the molecular genetic system, there's also a very well defined and developed classical genetic system. And that's in large part because of the limited fact that these cells can either stable haploids or diploids. And the diploid cell can be induced to undergo meiosis, or what we call sporulation induced.
Is it on the arm, is it on the lobes, is
and then the cytosol, it's a non plasma membrane. Okay. So you can actually do cell biology as well, and cellular localization of diseases. So it's just some of the experimental advantages to working with the system. Okay, so it has all these experimental advantages, but as I said, it also has the advantage of being a typical eukaryotic cell. So let's just spend a minute thinking about what that means. So when you think about what distinguishes a eukaryotic cell from a prokaryotic cell, what do you view as being the hallmarks of being a eukaryotic cell? So both the mitochondria and the nucleus are one of, let's just generalize and say, when you think about eukaryotic cells compared to prokaryotic cells, they have intracellular organelles, membrane-bound intracellular organelles. These steps has a very highly defined endoplasmic reticulum, Golgi apparatus, secretory vesicles, so it's got the whole secretory pathway that distinguishes eukaryotic cells from prokaryotic cells. And in fact, a lot of what we know about the secretory pathway has come from genetic screening areas. Other things about organization of the DNA. Has discrete chromosomes, okay, that are highly organized in nucleus of which. Okay. So, these cells have 16 chromosomes. That makes it possible to study chromosome segregation. They have that chromosome with sensory errors on one place where the microtubule is attached for segregation. So you can study those processes. And a lot of what we know about chromosome segregation is good to study things. Cytoskeleton, speaking of microtubules, there's an actin based and a tubulin based cytoskeleton that you can find in the prokaryotic cell. All of the motor proteins that sit on those filaments and looping around in the cell, present to use. Other things. We already talked about one. They are a traditional eukaryotic ribosome. It is sense that they're more subunits, they're larger. But I would say that's not eukaryotic specific, but they're not unique to eukaryotes, but there are specific differences in those. What is probably unique is that there is a class of only found ER-associated ribosomes. So there's a mechanism of targeting proteins that are specific, tend to appear to the ER to those ribosomes to the ER. So there's a method of missing the recognition particle targets ribosomes to the membrane. So a lot of studies on translocation proteins into the ER. Some other things that we need.
Transcription and translation.
Okay, so in prokaryotic cells, transcription and translation are helpful. This is where you start to transcribe the gene and actually have a ribosome bind to it and start translating it. Whereas in eukaryotic cells, transcription is occurring in the nucleus, translation is occurring in the cytosol, so there's mechanisms that are coupled. Splicing. And so actually only a small percentage of the genes have introns, but there are intron-containing genes in the spliceosomes, splicing mechanism in the cells. Protein modifications and difference in hypophosphorylation and other kinds of post-translational modifications that don't happen in prokaryotes that makes these differences super heterologous expression of protein. So if you wanted to express a protein or membrane protein, hard to influence because it's not through those resources and applications that are going to be divested into the other applications. Most of those have to be used. There's also a ubiquitin mediated proteolysis system. The G protein coupled receptors. Those are receptors in the plasma membrane that bind to extracellular signals and transduce the signal about the environment into the cell. There are no G protein coupled receptors in bacterial cells. The G protein coupled receptors. Okay, meiotic system, meiosis, doesn't happen in most people, so it's a correlation in some bacteria. So those are just some of the hallmarks of bacteria, just to help orient you the kinds of things that you study in this bacteria. So, with that, just sort of an introduction to the system, let's spend a minute thinking about the life cycle in this, and then think about how you need to set up a genetic screen and what you need to learn about. Right? So I already mentioned that we have halfway life cycle. So in fact, there are two types of haploid B cells, essentially male and female. These cells have they also have sex. So, but there's, you might have noticed when I said there were 16 chromosomes, I didn't say there was like a sex-specific chromosome. There's not. It's just one locus, one chromosome, that controls whether the cell is an A mater or not. So A mater means one, say essentially, equivalent to either male or female, and the other alpha is the other mater type. So the thing to understand, the cells of haploid cells of the A mater type, when they are mixed with haploid cells of the alpha mating type, they can A cells in the peptide called A peptide. And alpha cells have a receptor, which is called these G protein coupled receptors. So alpha cells have an A peptide receptor. Converse the alpha cells into the alpha peptide that binds to an alpha peptide receptor. So you mix the two haploid A cell culture with an alpha cell culture. The peptide is secreted by B cells, mine for this cell, and vice versa. And what that does, the G protein coupled receptor, when it goes to conformation change, transduces a signal into the nucleus, which causes the cells to transcribe a different set of genes, which are involved in allowing the cells to fuse with each other. First thing that happens is the cells synthesize what are called the lignans. They're essentially very sticky proteins on the cell surface. So when two cells physically contact each other, they physically stick together. And then the cell wall and the cell membrane join fuse together. And so you get what's first called the heterochromogenic. And what that refers to is a cell, you cell finish the nucleus and not yet fuse. Okay. But shortly after that fusion of the cell wall and membrane together, you get the material, put in the nucleus, at which point you have a difference. So basically then, you can start with an A cell from an alpha cell. You put in one cell from the nucleus, and then from the next. Those cells will mate, this process I just described, form first the fused cell in two independent nuclei and eventually a diploid cell. It's two we start doing by Friday. We talk to you about separate necessary resources. That's the issue that we're talking about. That's also something that's the body needs. And the way this says divide is when they're happily to get it. They have done it first with the mother cell. And the blood grows and the nucleus, the DNA separates. DNA replicates and then into the nuclei separate. And the daughter nucleus goes into the bud. And then you just get two daughter cells. So, essentially, that. So the diploid itself can grow mitotically or vegetatively. Just simply mitosis. And the diploid is stable, and we'll just keep going like that. But if the cells encounter conditions, austere conditions, for example, starvation or desiccation, something that prevents them from being able to grow, they don't have the conditions to grow, then the cells can undergo mitosis or sporulation. Okay. So usually, experimentally, the way we reduce it is we put them in media that lacks nitrogen. The cells will then produce, the diploid cells will be induced to undergo this sporulation or meiosis. And they form, as I mentioned before, tetrad. And in this tetrad, you'll end up with two alpha and two A haplotypes. Okay, because the mating type mentioned earlier, the growth that determines whether it mates is a pair or an alpha, is a single genetic locus. Without getting too much into the details, that locus encodes transcription factors that cause the cells to either elaborate a set of genes that are specific to the way cells or to express the same genes that are specific to the way cells. Questions about that process? able to hear that?
I don't know what you're saying about that.
Okay. Well, operationally, the way you would know that in the lab, if it's an ag meter, it can make an alpha. If it's an alpha meter, so what you have is a sort of tester strain. If you want to know if the culture you have, so if you let it grow, you can take a few cells and say, okay, now take these cells and I mix it with an alpha, and it makes and I know it's an X. I mix it with an alpha and it fails to make an alpha. So basically, you test.
After you do the whole experiment.
At this stage, you don't know. Well, you just keep the four spores separate. Just start four cultures so that you know that whatever cell you took was either an A or an alpha, you don't know which it was. They want you to keep it separate so it can be whatever it is. You're going to physically separate the cells. Okay, so I'll tell you how you do that. That's called type of analysis. And you can actually take the spore, look at it under a microscope, and with a needle, you can disrupt the axis. So you take it while it's still in the spore, but you pick it up on a needle and you disrupt it, and then you use the needle to pick up each individual spore and move it to a separate place in the space. And then they start forming a product group, they form a culture in a colony. But that colony is either an A or an A. And if you have four colonies from each group, you don't know which one is which until you test. So you have to find out the test for spore and the needle is an A. You could determine it by looking at the genes in the spore. So if you didn't know what your strain was and you didn't have a test for spore, the first test of strains are only confirmed to be either A or alpha. All that is really known is you take this strain and you made it with half of the others, you made it. Okay. So operationally, just define something as A and alpha. But knowing now that the basis of A and alpha is, which is just what the genes are turning on, you could do another test and say, is this making the way to move or make more of the genes? So you could do it that way. It's much easier just to test another test and see if it's going to look better. I'm not talking about how you know when you go over here. I'm sorry. Is it always a difference between 2 alpha and 2 A because it's a single gene locus. So in the 2 A cell, one of the consists, well, one of the chromosomes has the A information, and the other one has the R. So when they move on meiosis, first they replicate, and then they divide. So if it's 2 that happens, then you get the A comes so it always goes to it's a single gene locus, and any single gene locus is always going to say from 2 to 2 in the test. Any other questions? So a given gene locus of the A and alpha is always going to say you have 2 to 2. But it started out linked to some other gene that's close to it, or even not close to it, and get a recombination that separates the A locus from some other gene that started out linked to it. And that's how you do genetic linkage analysis and you can do genetic linkage. Heterozygous for that locus, meaning that one chromosome carries a certain kind of information at that locus, for example, the A-native information, and the other chromosome in the difficult cell carries a different kind of information, a different allele of that genetic locus, alpha in the case of A-native type, and then they go through sporulation for meiosis. In the four haploparts in meiosis, two are going to get one of those alleles, the A, so two of the A. And two are going to get the other two of the alpha. And that's the same for any heterozygous locus in yeast. So if you had a mutant that couldn't make 50K, okay? Imagine a mutant saw that couldn't make 50K. So And then in that same point, so heterozygous for that gene, you also have a chromosome that carries an allele of the TRP1 gene, which is defective. And so cells that inherit this chromosome will be able to grow without tryptophan. Cells that inherit this gene will require tryptophan to grow, right? So if you let that diploid cell go through meiosis, two of the parts of meiosis will be wild type gene. So the important thing is, if in fact the tryptophan phenotype is controlled by a single gene, if the haploid that you made it that was TRP minus, was TRP minus because of a single gene mutation in that gene, and the other haploid is wild type. If it's a single mutation at a single locus that's causing that, then when you go through meiosis, you're going to get two wild type TRP plus chronic meiosis and two TRP minus. Requiring oxytrophic. Okay. All right. Does that make sense? Of course. We'll come back to it. We'll come back to this. But basically, for a given gene, it's that two always to get 2-2 segregation among the parts of the meiosis. But if you're looking at two genes that are looking at the segregation of two genes. So not a single locus, but two separate locus. So let's say you start with a cell. For the sake of argument, let's just say you have one haploid cell that has its wild type for both A and B, some hypothetical genes A and B. Then you make that with haploid B from the opposite mating type has mutation for both A and B. This is where you need to review meiosis, but I'm sure you follow me. If A and B are unlinked, they're on different chromosomes, then the A chromosome and the B chromosome segregate completely independently, right? So A is always going to segregate 2-2. So two haploid products somebody else is going to get the big A allele, which we're going to get the small. But B is going to segregate independently, right? If they're unlinked, they're going to segregate totally independently. So for, although A always has to go 2-2, B has to go 2-2. You can get any combination of the B segregation relative to A, meaning that B is always going to go 2-2. But in any particular spore, you could end up with this spore would be a big A, big B, okay? This spore would be a big A, big B, little A, little B, little A, little B. So this tetrad, when you look at A and B, is going to have four spores, two big A, big B, two little A, little B, okay? But this tetrad, where B segregated differently relative to A, is going to have one big A, one big B, part of the meiosis. One big A, one little B, one little A, one big B, one little B, little A, little B. You see that? Does everybody understand the point I'm making here? So this particular tetrad type is what we would refer to as a parental dye type. Have you talked about this at all? Yes?
No.
Sure, some of you have had this in genetics before, right? We've talked about tetrad analysis. So this is called a parental dye type. And what that refers to is both spores in the tetrad look like the parental haploids that you started with. So this haploid was a big A, big B. This haploid was a little A, little B. This tetrad has two big A, big B, this parental type, and two little A, little B, this parental type. So it's referred to as a parental dye type tetrad. But you'll get other kinds of tetrads out of that cross if the two genes are unlinked. And this one, so big A, big B, that looks like this parent, right? Big A, little B doesn't look like either parent. Okay. Little A, big B doesn't look like either parent. and little a, little b, looks like this parent. So you have four different kinds of artists in meiosis. One looks like one parent, one looks like the other, and the other two look like neither, but they're different from each other. That's referred to as a tetrachyte. You have four different kinds of spores, okay, in the tetrachyte. This would also be a tetrachyte. It's called, yeah, so PD is parental dimorphism. T is tetratype. Tetra means four, so there's four types, four different types of spores. So there's two ways to get that, two patterns of segregation of B relative to A that will give you a tetrad. Okay. And this tetrad, neither, none of the spores look like either. So you have a big A, little B, little A, big B, little A, big B. That's referred to as a non-parental dietype. Dye type because there's only two types of spores in that tetrad, and non-parental because neither looks like a fiber type. So that's the non-parental. So this is what you predict to get, your types of tetrads you get, if the two genes are totally in one. And that means you have one out of four parental, two out of four tetratype, and one out of four parental types. So now if you look at the table I gave you, reminding us of is that if the two genes are actually physically linked, then they're not going to segregate completely independently. So if A and B are actually on the same chromosome, okay, the big B, then big A will go with little b. Okay? So the only way to get big A to go with little b if they're physically linked is to get a crossover. Okay? And because the number of crossovers you'll get between A and B is directly proportional to how far apart A and B are on the chromosome, okay, the probability of getting a parental dietype versus a tetratype or a non-parental dietype is higher the closer together they are. Just intuitively, does that make sense to you? Okay. So if you get patterns of segregation of two genes that are not consistent with them being totally randomly segregating, that's evidence that they're physically close together on the chromosome. And that evidence would look like when you're doing tetrad analysis, so you make the two haploids together and you analyze the tetrads and determine whether or not they're parental dietype, tetratype, or non-parental dietype, and we just defined here. If you have a preponderance of parental dietype, a higher fraction of parental dietype than non-parental dietype. That's indication that the two genes are physically linked. And just intuitively, I think you can see that, right? Now, depending on what percentage of parental dietype to tetratype to non-parental dietype, you can actually get an indication of how tightly linked the two genes are. Okay? So, I mean, if you never uncouple these two genes, you always get parental dietype. That tells you they're physically very close. But you can also have indication that they're linked, but they're not 100% linked. You do see things other than parental dietype, but you don't see the ratio that you predict if they were totally unlinked. Okay? So this leads to the concept of mapping, being able to do genetic mapping. And this turns out that I'm not going to get into the whole mathematics of it, but if they're totally randomly sorting the two genes, then you predict a ratio of PD to MPD of 1:1:4. If I sit here, it would be 1:1:2. But this is taking into count probabilities that you might have a crossover from your sentiment. And I don't want to get into the details too much of this to think about it, but basically, I would be satisfied if you just accept that the ratio for random is 1:1:4, PD and PD to T. Okay. If they're linked, then PDs are going to become more prevalent. The NPD is going to become less prevalent. And depending on how tightly linked they are, you're going to get different ratios. But the point I want to make is you can actually calculate a blue tetrad analysis a what's called a genetic matrix in centum organs. So centum organs is a measure of the, actually it's a measure of the rate of recombination of human tetrads, which is a correlates with the physical distance between the two chains. And the formula is dissect the number of tetrads, and you determine whether the tetrad is either a parental diatype, tetratype, or non-parental type. You count those up, and the distance of centum organs between the two genes you get, and then calculate is 100/2 or 50 times the number of tetratype tetrads you get, plus 6 times the number of non-parental diatypes over the total number of tetrads that you looked at, even as in humans plus two. And that gives you a measure to get this to you. Brought to me, of course, for these now, because we've got the whole genome, you can correlate the physical distance between those exactly the genetic distance that's calculated based on the combination frequencies. And it turns out that the rate of recombination that comes in is not very constant across the world. There are some areas called hotspots where recombination is more likely to occur. Some of those called cold spots, so it's not as likely to occur. But in general, if you average all the genetic data with the actual physical data, I think maybe there's about 100 tetrades. I think about 1% recombination for 10,000 base pairs of kids. So if you're measuring a percent of organ distance, this is about 100% by 10. So I think 10 centimeters corresponds to about 10,000 base pairs. I mean, I'll check on it. You might find it on the website too. But let me just take you to the problems that we're going to have. So I told you that I was going to give you some linkage data to look at. You can just calculate the distance between two genes. So what the table on the very last page is, it's a, the experiment is described on the page before it. But basically, you're taking two haploid cells that are homozygous for two markers, a lysine marker and a sex marker that causes some gene effect. And you're doing the tetrad analysis, you know, telling you what the genotype was. So minus lysine means it inherited the lysine minus mutation. Plus, if it can grow without lysine, it has the positive lysine gene. If it can't grow at 37, it's got the TS mutation. If it can grow at 37, it's got the wild type. Okay. And so what you have to do is look at this data and decide whether it's a parental diatype, tetratype, or a non-parental diatype, and then use that to calculate the distance between the two genes. Okay. And once you do that, you can actually go to the website, the genome database, which I showed you, and you can try to physically figure out how far apart those are those two genes. Right. And that's just a useful exercise to think about how to apply. So I just, right. And we can talk about it on Tuesday when you come in and go through it. Okay, what I haven't told you, by the way, what I'm going to do, if it's okay with you guys, is I'm going to lecture right through the break, and then we're going to quit at about 11:10. Okay. So we have a visiting scientist in the department today, and I'm supposed to be there at 11, but I said I'd be there by 11:15. Okay. So I thought the lecture was from 9 to 11 when I originally scheduled that, but she's visiting. She's actually interviewing for a position in her department, so I felt badly saying that wasn't going to make it. So we're just going to skip the break and you can go until about 11:10. All right. We're going to do that even if it's not okay. Right. How However, if anybody needs to leave, please, Beth, whatever, I won't be offended if people step out from it. I know it's a long time to sit, so. Okay, so let's just spend a minute thinking about how an experiment like the one that I described in this handout is actually done. Basically, what I want to tell you is I said, you know, you can take a domain, an alpha main or main, and get the difference. How do you select for the difference? When you mix these two populations together, you're not necessarily taking individual cells. You're taking one colony that's an alpha main, mixing it with an A main, and certainly you'll get a lot of the haploids mating, but not all of them, because there may be more A's than alphas, and they can only mate if there's a partner, right? So at the end of the mating experiment, you want to be able to select the difference. Okay? And so the way you design these experiments is so that the haploids have complementary opposite properties. And so in this experiment that I gave you the data from, that's the data from the lice plus cell, and this is the A main, right? It has 18 PSV. So it can grow without lysine, but it can't grow hydrogen. The other main that we dissect the tetrads, and you get the data that I show you on the next day. So is that clear to everybody? What the data is telling you. Okay. All right, so now we're ready to think about how we would actually, we have basically the tools in place to figure out how are you going to do this mutant screen morning and morning. So I'm going to use as an example the screen that's described in that historic paper I gave you at the beginning. I told you it's the Hartwell paper on making reflection mutants with mutations in the cell divisions. Okay. So we're just going to work through that as if we were doing that experiment. So this experiment was actually done in the around 1970 by Lee Hartwell. And what he did was to generate a very large collection of temperature-sensitive mutants in yeast. Okay. So he reasoned. So I told you that you could grow by bud. So if you look at a yeast cell under the microscope, you can actually tell exactly where in the cell division cycle the cell is just by the size of the bud. So this is another one of the really advantages of working with yeast. In most eukaryotic cells, as you look under the microscope, you see a cell, but you have absolutely no idea what stage of the cell cycle the cell is in, right? But we know in yeast, when it has a tiny bud, it's just entering S phase. Okay. By the time the bud is large, it's going into M phase. But of course, you can tell after it's divided. So So basically, let's get back and think about this. So let's start with this little bit of computer science. Right about the time that the butt emerges, if you were looking like more sophisticated method at the nucleus, you would know that there is a microtubule organizing center on the nuclear membrane that's called the spindle whole body. And right about the time the bud emerges, the spindle whole body starts to do. Ultimately, what's going to happen is this microtubule organizing center is going to duplicate. It's going to migrate to the other side of the nucleus. The nucleus is going to replicate. The two nuclei are going to separate and be pulled apart, one to the mother and one to the daughter side. The important point here is that the stage we have bud emergence, bud emergence stage, we know that that's where the spindle pole body is duplicated. And we also know that that's the beginning, the initiation of DNA synthesis. Later on, when the bud's a little larger, we know that the spindle pole body is separated. And that DNA replication is finished. Spindle pole body separated. And then, when the daughter cell is almost as large as the mother cell, we know that when we're looking at the nucleus, so if we're staining for DNA or when we're looking for the spindle pole body with an antibody, we know that the nucleus would have migrated to the neck. And that you're starting to see the cytoplasmic microtubules interacting with the spindle pole body. The nuclei are about to separate and pull apart. Spindle pole body elongation, spindle elongation. And nuclear division. The nuclei are actually separated now into the daughter cells. And then you go into late nuclear division and cytokinesis. So the point I'm making here is that it's very easy just to look at the cell and have a pretty good idea where in the cell cycle the cell is at. Okay. So the stage between when nuclear migration is finished, the cell's going to go into mitosis. This is the G1 phase of the cell cycle. This would be the phase in the cell cycle where DNA synthesis is occurring. This is a gap phase. G2, and this is where mitosis is. Okay? So unlike other cells, you can just look at the cell under the light microscope, and you can tell where in the cell cycle it is by the size of the bud. Okay? So what Hartwell reasoned is, okay, well, there must be proteins, enzymes, structural proteins that are required for each stage to go from one stage of the cell cycle to the other. And we could identify those. So we assume that if you get a mutation in one of those proteins, that causes it to be inactivated at high temperature, the cell is going to stall in that stage of the cell cycle where that protein was required. Okay. So obviously, you're going to get TS mutations that are in a lot of essential cellular processes that have nothing to do with cell divisions. So if you get a mutation in glucose metabolism, a mutation in any other essential process, you can get a TS mutant. When you shift the cells to high temperature, the prediction is if they are dying for some other reason besides a block in cell division cycle, then there will be no uniform arrest phenotype. They'll die at whatever stage of the cell cycle they're in. On the other hand, if the mutation is causing a block in progression through the cell cycle, this hypothesis was that a TS mutation that stops growing at 37 degrees because of a cell division cycle block will arrest at a certain stage in the cell cycle. So if you have a mutation that blocks spindle pole body separation, okay, all the cells, after you shift to the higher restrictive temperature, should arrest with the same cell division cycle phenotype. So they're going to all arrest with a small body. If you have a mutation that affects mitosis, the prediction would be all the cells will arrest with a large body. So you understand the rationale for what he was doing. So it was what he decided to do was do a screen to find a large collection of temperature-sensitive mutants, and then look at each mutant under the microscope after you shift it to the high temperature, and just take a subset of TS mutants that had a cell cycle-specific phenotype at the restrictive temperature. So we incubated at 37 degrees for a few hours, look under the microscope. You saw all kinds of cells at every stage of the cell cycle, throw it away, wasn't of interest to you. But if they all arrested with a uniform bud arrest phenotype, this could be a cell division cycle gene, a gene that's required for progression through the cell. Make sense? So that TS mutant collection, of course, is powerful, and people still screen it. They mine it still to this day, because, for example, if you could figure out what you think your phenotype should be at high temperature, then you could go back to that TS collection and say, I'm not interested in things that arrest with a uniform cell division cycle phenotype. I'm interested in things that can't secrete high temperature. So you screen the TS mutant for, you have a screen for secretion. You might put a marker, some kind of a protein that you can tell whether or not it's been secreted into the media, into the TS cells, and then ask, I'm looking for things where I never see that thing get into the media, and I think that would identify mutants involved in secretion, and so on and so forth. Right? Does that make sense? Okay, so what, again, so what I want to do is just sort of, let's pretend we were doing this experiment. So on and so forth. This is where I challenge you to think about, you know, something you might be interested in, how would you design a screen to find it. And ultimately, the value of the mutant collection is dictated by how much wisdom you had in deciding how to do the screen to find that class of mutants that you were interested in. So the mutant collection is only as good as the assumptions that went into thinking that if I had a mutation, it would have this sort of a phenotype. This is a classic full genetic screen. You think you know what kind of phenotype you should have, and you screen for genes that have it, and then you work backwards to find out what actually mutated caused the phenotype. So, again, you could give TS mutants in any process that was essential for cells to grow, and he decided to focus on the subset that had a cell division cycle phenotype, a specific arrest phenotype when you shifted to high temperatures. And so, let's say, we were doing this experiment and we're just going to focus. Yes? Well, if you EMS mutagenize, then you have lots of mutations in the genome. I think that might be addressed in the paper that I give you, but basically
what you do is you EMS treat to a certain level of killing. Okay, so obviously, if you EMS mutagenize very heavily, a lot of the cells just won't survive because you're going to get mutations in essential genes and you're not going to be able to the cells won't be able to divide. So I think the argument goes if you're getting about 10% killing, you have a reasonable chance of having a mutation in almost every gene. Okay. Because a lot of mutations won't be lethal. So just operational people, probably you can calculate this, but people strive to get about 10% killing with the mutagenesis to give them a reasonable chance of getting a mutation in the gene of interest. Make sense? So, say we did this experiment and we decided just to take the subset of mutants that have a small bar test. Okay? And we do these experiments using the claim to see it's advantageous to do the screening both the main haplotype and the reason for that is once you have your population of mutants, if you pairwise cross them, you can get information about how many genes mutated in the screen. So let's think about it. Let's say we ended up with let's pretend this is the data we need. I'm not going to go through this table exactly because I'm going to read it myself, but the idea is you get several mutations that can't that rest with a small bud, for example, at 37 degrees. You get several in the A type, you get several in the alpha. Now, how are you going to work with that collection? One thing you could do, where I said you can clone, you have to do several things, but first thing you have to do is figure out whether your mutation is recessive or not. You did this screen in a haploid cell, okay? So you really don't know whether the mutation you got is recessive or dominant because you've done it in a haploid.
Right.
If you did it in a diploid and have a phenotype, it would be have to be dominant. Okay. But if you do it in a haploid, it could be recessive, it could be dominant. Generally, it's much harder to get dominant mutations in a process than recessive. And usually, you want to look for recessive mutations. Recessive mutations generally tend to be a loss of function mutation. Dominant tends to be a gain of function. They're doing something that, despite the fact that the wild type protein is there, they still somehow interfere with the process of interest. Generally, you're looking for recessive mutations, but you need to be, in order to, the next thing you want to do with this collection is try to decide how many genes mutated to give me the phenotype. So let's say you start with 6 alpha mutants and 6 A mutants that have the phenotype. Are all 12 of those mutants defective in the same gene? Or do the 12 mutations all have mutations in different genes? How complex is that mutant collection? One gene we're getting over and over again? Are there going to be many, many, many genes that can mutate to that point? So that's a piece of information you want to have. Among other things, you want to know how many genes are involved, but you also want to know how is your collection becoming saturated? Is 12 mutants enough? You're going to find different things if you keep looking. If you looked at 12 mutants and you were getting the same thing in all 12 of them, you might say, there's probably not a lot of point in getting 100. But if you have 12 and you've got 12 different genes and you say, well, I'm nowhere near saturating the number of genes that I could get. So you want, there's information you want to get about the collection early on to get an indication of what are you going to find. So let's say you take that, so you've got 6 A's and 6 alphas. Well, I think you've already talked about complementation analysis, right? So the idea is if you take the 6 A's and cross them with the 6 alphas, if they're all in the same gene, all of the diploids are going to be TS, and the rest of the bottom of this gene type 2, if they're resistant. On the other hand, if you get, you cross them all pairwise, and you never get a diploid that's TS with a bunch of this mutant. That is an indication you have 12 different genes. But again, this is predicated on the assumption that the mutations are recessive. Okay, so how do we test that? Just back cross into the wild type. Okay, so now let's say you've got these TS mutations. So here's your alpha strain of TS mutations. Cross it back to the wild type A. And if this TS mutation is recessive, then this will have the wild type gene, this will have the recessive gene, so the diploid cell will be heterozygous for the TS mutation, right? It's a single gene mutation. It'll be heterozygous for mutation, and the diploid will be not TS. So for all the recessive mutations,
So you test them all by back crossing into wild type and you determine whether they're dominant or recessive. Everybody understands how you do that? Again, taking advantage of the fact that your starting strains, when you designed the screen, would have had complementary oxygens. So that when you cross the alpha to the A, you can select them. And then, so once you decide they're recessive, there's really another question. I would probably do the complementation analysis next. But there's another question you need to resolve eventually. Just because it says a TS phenotype doesn't mean the TS phenotype is caused by a single gene mutation. There could be multiple mutations that are required together to give you the TS phenotype. So that's where the genetic linkage and the peptide analysis becomes very valuable. Remember, if it's a single gene mutation, the prediction is that it will segregate 2 to 2. So when you take this diploid and let it go through meiosis, if there was a single gene responsible for that temperature sensitive mutation, then out of the products of meiosis from that diploid, 2 will be TS, 2 won't. If you needed multiple mutations to cause the TS phenotype, then when you let this go through meiosis, you're going to get less than half of all the products of meiosis being TS, because you have to inherit all the genes that are required to give you the TS phenotype. And I'll come back to this, to exactly how you do that in a minute. You can see that you could determine just by asking how does the TS phenotype segregate out of the diploid, whether it's a single gene or not. If it's a single gene, it will always segregate 2 to 2 among the products of meiosis. If more genes than one are required, you're going to get less than half the products having the phenotype. All right, so let's go to the complementation process. Now, let's just work with it. So you have paralyzed cross, again, we would have established that all of these mutations are recessive. So when you cross them to wild type, I'm going to use plus to indicate can grow at high temperature, minus to indicate cannot. Okay. So you would have established that when you back cross them to wild type, from wild type to wild type, of course. So what this indicates is when you take the alpha 1 mutant, back cross it to create wild type, the diploid is able to grow. Alpha 2, same. Alpha 3, same. And of course, wild type to wild. When you take the A1 TS mutant, back cross it to the alpha wild type, that tells you all three of your A mutants are recessive, and all three of your alpha mutants are recessive. Is that clear? So now you start pairwise crossing. And let's say what you find is this is what you find among your diploids. That gives you an indication that A1 and alpha 1 are likely to have a mutation in the same gene. Because the diploid cannot give you back a wild type phenotype, that means that both mutants had a TS mutation in the same alpha mutation. Alpha 2 and A1 seem to have a mutation in the same gene. It looks like A2 and L3 have a mutation in the same gene. Does that make sense? Does everybody understand what kind of information we're getting here and why it's helpful? Does anybody need more elaboration on this? Research? I know you've talked about this.
I definitely do.
Okay. So the idea is, we've established that the mutations are recessive, right? Is that clear? If it's not, it's okay. You start with a TS mutation, and you cross it to a wild-type strain. So this strain is TS, this one's not. If this is a recessive mutation, since this is not TS, it must have the wild-type counterpart, that gene. And therefore, the diploid is heterozygous, and if it's not TS, that means this was a recessive mutation. If this was a dominant mutation, then this diploid would be TS, because dominant means the TS phenotype trumps the wild-type phenotype, right?
Still confused?
Yeah.
Okay, do you know what's confusing you? Can you?
Could you just say that again?
So when you do this cross, okay, maybe just to make it more concrete, this cell has a mutation which we really need to set. We haven't proven, but for the sake of argument right now, let's say it has a mutation, a single mutation in a protein, that when you put the cells at high temperature, that protein, because of the mutation, is very labile and it no longer functions. And it's an essential protein, so the cells can't grow anymore. Okay? Now, if you cross that to a wild type cell, that mutation will still be there, but that the other haploid cell had the wild type gene, so it's making a normal protein. Okay? And so when you put it at high temperature, yeah, this protein unfolds and is no longer functional, but you don't really need it because you have another gene that's making that protein that's doing the essential process. So as long as the diploid is not TS, you can conclude that the mutation is recessive. Okay? Okay, now when you pairwise cross two mutants with the temperature sensitive phenotype, if they have mutations in the same gene, neither haploid cell is going to give you a gene that can make a wild type protein. This haploid is going to give you this TS mutation that gives you a labile protein, for example. And this haploid mutation is going to give you the same labile protein. Maybe a different mutation, but it still has a defect in the same protein. So the diploid is not going to have any active protein. If both mutations are recessive, and when you pairwise cross them, you end up with the phenotype, temperature sensitivity. That tells you that they have mutations in the same gene because they can't complement each other. So that's what you're getting from the complementation table. You're getting an indication of how many genes mutated to give me this phenotype. And so in this simplified hypothetical example, we're getting an indication, okay, well, there's one gene that's defined, A1 has the same mutation that alpha-1 has because the diploid can't grow at high temperatures. The A1 mutant has the same mutation that alpha-2 has. So that tells you A1, alpha-1, and alpha-2 apparently all have a mutation in the same gene. So there's one gene out of the six. Three of them in one. A2 and L3, because the diploid is TS, must have mutations in the same gene. And then the last thing is, it looks like alpha-3 is a unique mutation. It's not the same as any of these three A mutations. And alpha-3 is not neither A1 or A2. Okay? So it gives you an idea how many genes mutated. Among those six, how many different genes? So among those six, what do we have? One, two, three. So there's three in that one, two. How many genes do we have here? We have. These are all the same. So that's one gene, right? There's two genes. So we have three genes, right?
Looks like.
In our collection. Three different genes that mutated to get those six mutant phenotypes. So that would be an indication to me that I should keep screening because I haven't saturated the collection. Looks like I'm going to find more mutations if I keep going. Okay. Can we move on? It is. It is, and if you think about models, it takes more than one mutation to make the TS phenotype, the probability that you're going to get a negative in the diploid becomes lower and lower anyway. Okay, because it requires multiple mutations to get the TS phenotype. They have to get the same multiple mutations to give you a failure to complement. But the easiest way to address that is let's just think about that question right now. So it's especially the case if you find a mutant that is not in a complementation. You never find, let's say for alpha 3, you do a lot more screening, and you never find another mutant that fails to complement the alpha 3 mutation. Okay.
that might be a clue that that mutation has multiple, there are multiple mutations required for the TX, right? Because it becomes harder to get non-complementing mutants if it takes more than one mutation to give you the mutant phenotype, right? If we're saying that to get that TS phenotype, let's go with this model. So we've got a blood emergence defect that's causing a TS phenotype, right? Let's say that you actually, there's two functionally redundant proteins that can accomplish whatever function is missing in that mutant, okay? So there's two functionally redundant. So to get a TS mutant, failure for that function to occur, you have to get mutations in both genes. It's just the nature of mutagenesis that it's hard to get mutations in two genes, right? And so in order to get something that fails to complement that, you have to have another mutant that also has mutations in both of those functionally redundant genes. And that's less likely to happen, okay? And so if you get a mutant in your TS collection, which you fail to ever find another mutant that fails to complement it, you should be suspicious that it's not a single gene mutation. But you can test that directly. So let's say we took the alpha 3 mutant and we back crossed it to wild type. We're testing the hypothesis. One mutation. So if it is a single mutation, then the dip point is going to be like that mutation. And we let that dip point go in formulation. And we get the four products in the meiosis. It's a single gene. We expect two of them to be TS. So in every single test, we expect to see two TS and two non-TS. And if we get that result, yes, it was a single gene mutation. But let's see what would happen if there were actually two genes that had to mutate to cause that phenotype. Let's assume they're on one. So in order to get this TS phenotype, let's say A and G, A and B both have to be TS. And so this is a model where for A and B code function redundant proteins. So there's two human genes. In order to get the phenotype, we have to get mutations from both of them. Right? And they're unlinked. Now when you back cross this to wild type, you've got a cell that is heterozygous for two TS mutations. So if you let that go through meiosis, those two genes segregated heterozygous. A is always going to go through the two. But B is going to segregate independently of that. So we're back to that example I showed you in the beginning, where B can segregate independently of A. You can get any pattern of B with A. And remember what we're saying is you have to have both little A and little B to get a TS product in meiosis. Okay. So how many, this would be a TS. This would be TS. TS. Those are only four out of the 16 possibilities are TS. So instead of half of all the products of meiosis being TS, only 25%. And if you see that, that tells you that your original mutation was not a single gene mutation. There were actually two genes that mutated. Okay. I think what I'm going to do is stop here. Let's think about that. But do not come on Tuesday. If you come back on Tuesday and you don't understand that, you are doing something wrong. Okay? Which means either figure it out or find it. Okay? Because we can't move on if this isn't the business. Right? And I'm going to assume when I start on Tuesday, I'm going to understand that. Okay? Okay. And meanwhile, what you have now, I think, will make sense is this homework that I gave you is this table. What I want you to do now is look at this table and make as many conclusions as you can. Tell me if the genes are dominant or recessive. Tell me how many genes mutated and cause the phenotype. Tell me whether you think you should keep screening or not. Tell me if you think any of them might have more than one mutation. Tell me if you think there's anything funny going on. Really think about it, okay? Because that'll be where we start on Tuesday. It should be fun, by the way. These are this is a single crossover, and this is multiple crossovers. It's just making the point you can get the same